Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts has already activated stay limits on the Family Emergency Shelter System. Governor Healey signed the limits into law earlier this week. Now, about half of the families in the system and on the waitlist for shelter are coming from other countries. But the shelter system is not the only option for new migrants. There's also sponsorship. And that's when a group of people volunteer to support an individual or family. And we're going to dive into how that works and how it's working here. And we'll start with recent reporting from WBUR's Simone Rios. Simone, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So just briefly, Simone, what is sponsorship?
Yeah, so sponsorship in the context that my reporting took me is a program called Humanitarian Parole. So this goes back to the 1950s in the aftermath of World War II. It's been used by administrations from both parties for a variety of international immigration crises, basically allowing people a temporary pathway into the U.S. while things get sorted out in their countries. So people are let into the country for a certain period. They can work here, and then they either extend their status or get married or whatever the situation might be, or they have to go back home. The Biden administration first uses humanitarian parole to help people from Afghanistan and Ukraine, which we'll talk about. And then in 2023, in January, it was extended to people from some of the most troubled countries in this hemisphere. So Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. And the program allows up to 30,000 people a month to fly into the U.S. from those countries after passing background checks, as long as they have sponsors here. So a lot of them are coming to Massachusetts. So, instead of arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, these folks are applying in their home countries, waiting in some cases for up to a year or even longer. And the Biden administration points out that encounters at the border with people from those four countries is down significantly.
And the sponsor here, Simone, is someone who says, I will be, or a community who says, we will be, a group of people here who will receive the person, provide some financial housings and support, et cetera. That's what the sponsor does?
Right. So in the case of the CHNV, Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela program, I interviewed a gentleman named Hanania Pierre-Louis, who himself came to the U.S. when he was 15. His parents died when he was just 5 in Haiti, and he was adopted by the family's pastor. Since then, he did very well for himself. He studied, became a nurse, but he always wanted to bring help, wanted to bring family from Haiti, but there was never a way to do that until now. Let's hear from Hanania.
It was always like a burning desire of mine to have a route to bring my family over because of the constant turmoil and instability in Haiti, mainly for, to give them a chance to survive and pursue their goals.
So, despite the tremendous political instability in Haiti and natural disasters, he says, over the past 25 years, there was never a pathway that he could use to bring family until January of 2023. And he actually applied for several family members. Three of them were approved. He bought a house in Dorchester where they all live now. They're all studying English one of them is at Roxbury Community College. All three of them are working in service sector jobs. One's working at a Chipotle, another at an Amazon warehouse, and another at an assisted living place.
So we're talking about sponsorship of people coming to the United States under a variety of forms, starting with reporting from Simone Rio. So now, tell me about one of the family members who's come.
Yeah, so the one that I focused on in my story is Karen Cesar. She's 20. She might have turned 21 already. And she's just this incredibly brilliant and vibrant young woman. I went with her one morning from their house in Dorchester to Roxbury Community College, and she's just like the most active person imaginable. She plays three sports. She's working. She goes to church when she can, and she's in college. But I should say that underneath all this vibrancy, there's a sadness to many of these folks, Karen Cesar included, because their family, they still have family back in Haiti. And in their case, Karen's mother, Maxdala, who we spoke to in this story, is still in Haiti with her two minor children, two daughters. And they're all applying to come through the same humanitarian parole program. But because of a tremendous backlog, which I believe is over 1 million people at this point, they're just waiting and waiting. In the midst of my reporting, Maxdala found out that she was rejected. Didn't really know why. They got a letter, something to do with the sponsor, possibly applying for too many family members, and they got the news that they were rejected.
And what was Karen's, Karen's got to be worried.
Yeah, I mean, she told this story that actually we have some sound from her, that she was at a party and she got a call from her mother.
Imagine you kind of with your friend in a party and then your mom is calling you and started talking like that because they broke in a police station and they're killing people. There's no one you can turn to. And you're just stuck there in your house waiting for either if you're going to see tomorrow or if you're going to die.
Yeah, so there she was talking about these gang members who were in the neighborhood where their family home is. And yeah, her mom thought that might be the last chance to speak with Karen.
Then, of course, the gang activity continuing in Haiti. In a minute, we're going to add another form of sponsorship to this conversation. But for now, we're focused on sponsorship for people coming for humanitarian parole, which is a temporary time in the United States. You looked at who's pushing against this. Tell us a little.
For sure. I mean, this humanitarian parole program, specifically CHNV, Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela, has become a total lightning rod. You know, it's come into play with the impeachment effort against Alejandro Mayorkas, the DHS secretary.
Homeland Security.
And, you know, Donald Trump is talking about it. Ted Cruz using it to attack the Biden administration.
Senator from Texas.
Right. And so Texas and 20 other Republican-led states are suing the federal government over CHNV. They say they're being forced to foot the bill for all these people. Now, I should point out that the program requires sponsors who, in theory, are supposed to be supporting these people. That doesn't mean that some of the burden doesn't fall on the states, and that's the argument these states are making. A lower court judge ruled against the states, but now they're appealing. We have some sound from Oklahoma Senator James Lankford talking about how this is sort of a misuse of humanitarian parole.
Humanitarian parole was designed for a situation like what we had in Ukraine, or it was designed for a situation where an individual has a funeral that they've got to get to, but in their country it takes too long to get a visa and they couldn't get to the funeral, and so they get humanitarian parole to be able to come in and get to that funeral. It's not designed to say, y'all come.
So Republicans, you know, are trying to claim that this CHNV program is a backdoor way for people. And by the way, we're talking about more than 400,000 people since the beginning of 2023. The Republicans are saying it's a backdoor way for these folks who wouldn't otherwise be allowed entry into the country to get in. And I'll say also that Donald Trump, most people in this world agree that if he's elected in November, he'll do away with this humanitarian parole program.
Okay, so Simon, sit tight. Thank you for being here. I'm going to add another voice now. Sasha Chinoff is executive director and co-founder of the refugee resettlement nonprofit Refuge Point. In February of this year, he wrote two pieces for Cognoscenti, which is WBUR's ideas and opinion page on the immigration debate and how sponsorship immigration can be a solution. Sasha, welcome to you.
Tiziana, thanks. It's wonderful to be here. And Simone, your reporting on this has been terrific. Thanks for all you've done, too.
So, Sasha, you believe in this sponsorship model, not just for people who may come through humanitarian parole, but also for people who may have the kinds of status as migrants that would have them live here permanently. Yes?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, just to go back to a point you were talking about, Tiziana, with Simone, when these sponsorship and parole programs started, it reduced the number of people coming to the border. It kept people from risking their lives on dangerous and deadly journeys to try to get to the border because it creates legal pathways for people to come here. This is not something that we should be arguing about. It's terrible that it's a political hot button issue because it's about people's lives. It's about growing migration in the world and the need for more legal pathways. And what you've highlighted in your reporting, Simone, is the importance of this and the value of it and the contributors that arrive here through it.
And I will note at the beginning of our conversation, I talked about families who are in the state emergency shelter system. Every family in the state emergency shelter system is a legal resident of Massachusetts as part of that, migrant families included. That's part of this whole system. Sasha, I'll turn to you now. When you were writing in Cognoscenti, you were looking at another Biden administration policy rule program that was creating sponsorship opportunities for refugees who were seeking to come to the United States and live here permanently. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I started Refuge Point some time ago to help refugees resettle to the U.S. and find and build safe new lives. The U.S. has a resettlement program that was codified with the 1980 Refugee Act, which allows refugees from overseas who are identified because they can't go home and can't stay safely where they are to come to the U.S. through a legal process where they're interviewed overseas by Department of Homeland Security officials and approved for resettlement and go through extensive security exams, medical checks, and then finally arrive here. And once they arrive, they have a pathway to citizenship. Since 1980, we've brought in over 3.2 million refugees to the U.S. And the Biden administration, seeing the opportunities to bring people in and looking at the world and forced displacement and seeing that there are over 120 million people who've been forced to flee their homes, and that number will likely grow, recognized the importance of creating opportunities for Americans to sponsor and bring refugees in. So they created the Welcome Corps in January 2023, which allows Americans and people living here to do essentially what Simone was talking about, to form groups to sponsor refugees to come here. And those groups play an anchor role in that respect. What that means is that they're responsible for finding housing, they're responsible for finances, they're responsible for helping people integrate in schools, and they show people around their communities. And that Welcome Corps is a new and additional program that's related or part of the U.S. government's refugee resettlement program.
So I'm going to pick apart a couple of the finer details to have you clarify for us, Sasha. And the first is, when you say sponsor, are you saying that all financial obligations for the family that is coming are now assumed by the individual or group of people who are sponsoring?
Yeah, that's right. They have to raise about $2,500 a person, and they have to find housing. And then the people are supposed to find jobs and get on their own two feet as quickly as possible so they can support themselves. But that sponsor group is responsible initially for the finances and for helping out.
And second, when sponsorship happens, are you saying that the person that this community here in the United States sponsors would not otherwise be authorized to come to the United States unless a sponsoring family were there? And what's in my mind in particular is someone who could no longer stay in Afghanistan, for example, after the cessation of the U.S. war there, would not be able to come as a refugee here without a sponsorship family?
Yes,
TCM. That's an esoteric example.
But. Yeah, no, but that's exactly right. The people who are stepping up and forming sponsorship groups, and you're supposed to have at least five people in a group who can form a group and then send for people overseas, those people they're sending for are in life-threatening danger right now. It is the most compelling and important thing right now. As you mentioned, there's so many people who are in danger in Afghanistan and who fled to Pakistan. Refuge Point actually has staff around the world helping refugees access the U.S. resettlement program. So we have staff in Pakistan, and the dangers that Afghans are facing there are horrific. But it's absolutely true that sponsors are saving people's lives through this program, and otherwise they might not survive.
And coming up actually in a few minutes on the show, we're going to speak to a member of a sponsorship group and a woman who came from Afghanistan as part of a sponsorship program and is living here in Massachusetts. Before we do, I want to come back to you, Simone Rios, ask one more question on this front. Families or individuals can in your reporting, you had one person who was sponsoring family members for humanitarian parole.
Yeah.
Is that the limitation in the version that you're looking at? Or could a whole neighborhood sponsor a whole family for humanitarian parole from the four countries you were focused on?
Yeah, it seems like there's a few different policies here, but we're working within the general world of what's known as humanitarian parole. But in the case of the Cubans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, I've heard of individuals. So there's income guidelines. You have to make a certain amount. You have to be a certain amount above the federal poverty guideline to be able to qualify for one person. And then based on how much you make, you can qualify for others. And I've heard of some families applying for 10, 12, 15 people. Some individuals applying for this many people. But that doesn't seem to be a very successful approach. In Hanania's case, the 40-year-old sponsor I interviewed in Dorchester, he applied for at least twice as many as the three that were granted entry into the U.S.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we are learning about sponsorship immigration. That is when an individual or a group of people sponsor someone or a family to come to the country and help them settle. Still with us, WBUR's Simone Rios and Sasha Chinoff, co-founder and executive director of the refugee resettlement organization Refuge Point. And now, a recent example. Arazo Hakik is a refugee from Afghanistan who settled in Massachusetts as part of a sponsorship program. She now lives in Arlington with her family. And Grant Bennett is Arizo's former sponsor and former CEO of a company called CPS Technologies in Norton. They're here to talk about their experience. Arizo, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here.
Me too. I'm happy that I'm here with you guys here.
Thank you. And Grant, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
And again, Sasha and Simone both still with us as part of the conversation after setting up how sponsorship works. Arizo, why did you leave Afghanistan?
It was not a plan. We didn't imagine that we can live our life because we had a comfortable life there with my husband and three kids, aged 10 years old, 16, and 7 years old. So we have our own business and life, but this happened very suddenly when the Afghanistan Taliban took over the governor of Afghanistan. So we don't have any way to stay anymore because we was not safe there.
And because
there
you
risk
and
yeah.
You and your husband had been working with the United States.
Exactly, yeah, because our background working with the United States and implementation of their projects in Afghanistan, we was in risk, and it was the better way to leave the country to save myself with my kids and husband. So it was not an easy decision. We just decided to leave. And it was very hard. Because at the one day we decide to tomorrow, we was in the airport and it was not easy to get in. There was a lot of people, might be you seen in the TV and news, August 2021. Was a very trauma at that time. So finally, with a lot of efforts, and we tried many different gates, but finally, our name was in one of the evacuation lists due to our contribution to the United States. But no one believed us because there was thousands of people rushing to airport and trying to enter. So no one listened to us. We tell them we are in the list. We have to get out from the country and we are eligible for this evacuation, but no one listened to us. And finally, after 2 days, one night, we spent to our relative house because we was not able to back to our home because we just escaped from the house. So the next day we tried, and then finally we find another door. We went there, but there was a Taliban official there that didn't listen to me. I was crying in bottom of my heart and was very heartbroken. A lot of people, children. It was very hot weather after 8 or 9 hours standing back of that door. They put some burped ripe in the way to to block the people
some
not
pushing.
Yes, barrier to block the way the people not pushing the door. And we was sitting backside of that wire, and I was crying and in very, very bad condition. My daughter was scared. There was firing, shooting people, and some of people killed in front of us, and it was a very, really bad condition. So I just crying and asked them, my name is in the list, please let me, my kids will die, please let me, I go in, because there was thousands of people behind us, we cannot go back. Even I told to my husband, I don't want to go, I want to go back home, I want to don't save my kids, I don't want to my kids die here. So finally that person see my condition, I don't know, it was my luck or God help me, that person listened to me and asked me, where you are going? I said, my name is in the list, and it is a Qatar flight. I'm going to the Qatar. So he went there and talked to one of the official of the Qatar, and he comes to me and asks me, what's your name? He asked me to come enter. So I don't want to make this story very detailed, but I need to tell the people know how I came here. It was not easy. So that person asked me to come inside of the gate and talk and show me the list. So there was as I said, it was burp rap. It was not easy, but I jumped from them and it's all of my dress become turn. And then I came, finally showed them my passport and find my name. And I told them my kids is in behind of that door and they are going to die. Please help me. And my name was found on that list, and he helped me.
Good. I'm going to stop you there.
Sure.
And I didn't want to stop you sooner because you're right. We do need to understand. And I thank you for sharing that. I want to bring Grant now in to join you, Arzo, in this story. So, Grant, that's why you sponsored?
Yes. Yes. We didn't really know the full story of Arzu, and we've also been involved with Arzu's brother and his family. But in short, a neighbor and close friend said to me, I had just retired, and kind of out of the blue, they said, we're pulling together a group of neighbors who are going to sponsor a family that's fled from Afghanistan. Do you want to help out? And we got together one night and kind of sat around a room talking about, do you know something about healthcare? Do you know something about putting your children in school? And we divided up duties, and that's how it all began.
So, Grant, lots of people care, but they don't do that. They don't take that kind of step. What got you from I'm concerned to I am going to become part of a community that receives Arzo and her family once in her franticness she finally gets somebody to let her and her kids through the darn door, right?
Yes, yes. Well, in my case, it was a simple invitation from a neighbor.
But what made you say yes?
You know, what a wonderful question. My first reaction was, I have the time to help a stranger. And on a little more reflection, we're almost all immigrants in this country, and it struck me as an opportunity to give back a little bit. And then, but very quickly, it turned from, if you like, I'm helping someone out, to this is a wonderful, rich relationship that is a blessing in my life, and it has evolved to be just deeply satisfying.
In a moment, I want to bring Simone Rios and Sasha Chanoff back in too, but before I do, Arzo, a mutual blessing, a blessing for you and Grant, yes? A blessing to you too?
Thank you, yeah, of course. Yeah, I feel myself very lucky because this opportunity is not available for all refugees. So I was so lucky that I have the support from Neighborhood Support Team, NST. So they helped us a lot for housing, furniture, enrollment of school for kids, and finding job for me and my husband. So I feel so lucky that I have this opportunity. I wish everyone have this opportunity of people around to help them.
When you tell your story, are you also providing a blessing back by helping people understand the importance of this work?
Exactly, yeah. This is really a blessing. I definitely support this, yeah, this idea.
Sasha.
It's a life-saving opportunity. I just want to highlight, too, it's really thrilling to be here because Arezou just shared something with me when we were waiting to come in, Tiziana, that was really cool. Refuge Point, the organization that I founded and lead to find solutions for refugees, has helped about 140,000 people around the world access the U.S. resettlement program. But when the U.S. evacuated Afghans onto 8 military bases across the country, we sent staff to those bases to play the role of helping to identify people who would go into sponsor groups and helping people get off the bases and into communities. And Arezou just told me that a Refuge Point staff helped her when she was at Fort Dix in New Jersey come here to Massachusetts.
So that's how it happened for you.
Yeah, yeah. I was depressed, very depressed. That time when I was in the airport, I was feel so lucky that I saved myself and family. And then when later when I thought, oh, my God, what happened to us? What's happened to our house? We built our own house with our all job, business, everything. And important, our friends, relatives, my parents, my sibling. I left everything behind and come to the U.S. with one cloth and being in the camp without any activity or any other things. All like I was 6 months in the camp and it was not easy. So I got very bad depression. And at that time, my brother first come to the Massachusetts and he asked for the volunteers group NST to help my sister. It's in bad condition in the camp. And then Sasha organization or other NST group get together and help me to do independent departure. And they bring me out from the camp to the Massachusetts. And it was really blessing, and I was very happy with this.
Simone, before I turn back to Grant, I'm thinking in my head how this story compares and contrasts with the reporting that you did with the family coming from Haiti, coming to an uncle who had carefully constructed a life here with the specific idea of bringing his family.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Arezou was just saying, talking about everything she left back in Afghanistan, reminded me of something that came up in talking to Haitian families and talking to many immigrant families for that matter. And that's a sense of sadness at what they left behind. And to a person, the Haitians I spoke to for this story said that they want things to improve in Haiti so they can go back. Not just the folks who came here a year ago, but even Hananya, who came here 25 years ago when he was 15 years old, they want stability in that country. They want democracy. They want freedom and eventually to go back. I'm curious, Arezou, if you feel that way as well about going back to Afghanistan someday, or is this your permanent home now?
Yeah, this is seems like it's not secure for us to go there. Really, it's hard to accept that you will not go, be allowed to go to your homeland forever. It's so hard, but especially if I thinking about that, I will not going to see my parents and hug them once more. And it's really hard for me. My brother passed away a few months ago, and it was very heartbroken, and I was not able to go for his ceremony?
Funeral.
Yeah, funeral. So it's not easy, but compared to that, I'm safe here, and my kids are going to the school and are safe and having a good opportunity to educate my kids and myself. And this is like something that I accepted, and I like to be here to be safe.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Grant, we're having... Go.
Sorry. I just
this
wanted
Sasha.
To...
Go ahead, Sasha.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to point out that the Afghans who are evacuated here are also on humanitarian parole, which is what Simone was reporting about. And there is a bill in Congress, the Afghan Adjustment Act. In fact, I was just talking with Senator Klobuchar, who's a co-sponsor of that bill, last weekend.
Amy Klobuchar is Minnesota.
Senator from Minnesota, yeah. And we need to pass that. It has bipartisan support. It just hasn't gotten passed. But what that'll do is give Arezou a permanent right to be here.
Because otherwise this is temporary.
Otherwise this is temporary. And if the administration changes, this is very uncertain for people.
And you advocated for the education of women and girls.
Yeah, I forgot to mention this. I was a women activator, and I participated in many of the radio and TV programs like this, but in my own language. Mm-hmm. But I was a woman activist in Afghanistan.
So thank you, Sasha. That's an important added detail. And I may have sort of confused things when I didn't draw that out. So I appreciate that, that it's essential. Grant, I'm going to come back to you now on the sponsor side. Two questions for you. First, in this group where you said that night everybody met, okay, who knows healthcare? Who knows real estate, I'm assuming? What part did you know? What part did you do?
You know, I did not feel I had any particular expertise, but I volunteered to help find jobs. And quite frankly, it's been about 35 years since I've personally looked for a job. But I had hired a number of people at my place of employment and simply felt like I could navigate those waters. And it was a wonderful experience. I began first working with Arezou's brother and Arezou's sister-in-law, and he had done some worked at a fruit packing operation in Afghanistan, and we got in our car and we drove to Whole Foods and we walked up and down the aisle and stopped some employees and asked them about their job, and we went to Trader Joe's. We were trying to understand what he might really enjoy doing. We drove to Mount Albert Hospital, trying to think through jobs that he could get with essentially a high school education and no English. We stopped and chatted with someone who was transporting patients around. Then when it came time to apply and interview, we had a fun time. We identified some keywords like shift, pay, weekend, and we developed a script where he would listen for that word, and when he heard it, he would recite the script we had prepared and then say, did I understand the question?
Yeah.
But they're wonderfully employed, doing well, and it was just a delightful experience, frankly.
So, Simone Rios, we have had a number of conversations here in Studio 2, and there's been quite a range of reporting at WBUR about the fact that Governor Healey has talked about the fact that we need immigration in our workforce to fill jobs. What's been the conversation in our last 30 seconds or so with the family that you reported on and the jobs they're looking to fill here in the state?
Well, yeah, I mean, it varies by sector, but some sectors of the economy have a significant labor shortage. So a lot of advocates are talking about, for example, getting some of the recent immigrants working in the construction industry because we all need housing. But then I think many of them tend towards the service sector. The language barrier is a major issue. A lot of people I spoke to have had a really hard time finding employment because of that. So
major issue.
Yeah. So, you know, but as I said before, folks working, the people I talked to working at an Amazon warehouse, at a Chipotle serving burritos and working at an assisted living facility. So these are obviously things that we need filled, positions we need filled.
So much more we could talk about here. We'll end it for now, but I want to thank everyone for being here. You just heard WBUR's Simone Rios, Grant Bennett, a part of a sponsoring group. Obviously, Arezou Hakik, thank you for sharing the story of your family. And Sasha Chanoff, co-founder of Refuge Point, thanks to all four of you for being here.
Thanks
so much. Thank you for having us. Thank you.